Welcome to episode number 44 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I'm the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
And our guest today is Clint Basinger, creator of the Lazy Game Reviews YouTube channel. LGR's specialty is exploring the history of 1990s computer tech and games, as evidenced by a video we recently watched called Unreal Tournament 22 Years Later, an LGR Retrospective. I actually missed out on most of that era myself, and I imagine a lot of you did as well. So we invited Clint here to tell us all about it. Clint, welcome to the Video Game History Hour.
Hi, glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here.
I didn't say greetings.
Greetings.
I was really hoping that would be what you said.
The greetings is so official.
So I'm going to give a little bit of a behind the scenes here for the listeners. As I choked on LGR, it is because in my notes twice I typed LRG because we talk about limited run games a lot internally here because they're a big donor of ours. So if you caught that, that's what's going on. But anyway, Clint, welcome. Please tell us about your channel.
Well, I work for Limited Run Game. No, I don't. they do actually work pretty close by. We're in the same state, so that happens more often than you think, so don't feel bad.
Okay.
Yeah, my channel, LGR, is just sort of a place to dump all of my thoughts about computer history and software and just really diving into the whole realm of that I mostly remember, which largely goes from, you know, the 90s into the mid 2000s at this point, but I just kind of hop all over the place, you know, going from story to story or retrospective to, you know, building computers and repairing things. And I don't know, there's not really a theme except old computers are fun and I think they deserve to be remembered and preserved, and that's about that.
Well, I don't think it's fair to say it's just things you remember. I mean, you do a lot of exploring of things that you didn't experience at the time.
That's fair. Yeah, that's always sort of the kicking off point. I'll go down some path of something where I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember seeing that. Or I remember messing around with it. But then I'll start looking into it and I'm like, well, there's way more interesting history here going on behind the scenes. And then that turns into something else. And yeah, it's sort of an exploration of my own memories and then going back and seeing that either a lot of them were really wrong or I just had no idea of how complicated and how vast it got. Like somebody was just joking with me the other day that my channel is basically someone trying to come to grips with all of the tech of 30 years ago. Just, you know, still trying to understand the progress of technology, but 30 years ago.
Yeah, so. I like that because there's so much, just the breadth that you cover ends up being, there's just so much context to understand that I don't think even if you were hyper aware of it living through it, it would be difficult to just see the entire landscape at once.
Yeah, that's very much part of the whole appeal of it for me, especially some of my particular shows like Oddware, for instance. That's all these weird little tertiary devices and bits of hardware and software that came around, you know, when I was around. And I thought I knew about a lot of things that were happening at the time. But then I'll find a ton of bizarre peripherals and video cards and sound cards and things like that that I'd never heard of. And at one point, they were hugely promising, and everybody was talking about them, but it was like a month. And some companies just put millions of dollars into it, and all of a sudden, it was just gone in a flash. And yeah, finding those kind of fascinating stories where it seemed like they were promising the world, everything was going to change because of this, and then it just never did. So, love those kind of things.
I mean, that does, you know, strike me as being a fairly unique phenomenon to the 90s, maybe a little bit of the early 2000s, as you said. Why is that? Like, just from a historical perspective, you know, why is there so much odd technology shipping and being forgotten in this brief period?
I think the computer industry in general, it was just shifting so fast that everyone had their own idea of how to take advantage of it. And combined with, you know, falling chip prices at one point there, especially after the RAM shortage kind of stopped late 80s, early 90s. Everybody had access to cheaper chips, and then more and more manufacturing started coming about, and then you just had a mountain of, I don't even know how to call it, just, I guess creativity might be the right word. It's the cynical side of me wants to say just everybody wanted to make a little bit of money because there was a lot to be made, and everybody was moving on to something seemingly every 6 months. You know, oh, okay, so now we've got these Pentium chips. Okay, so what can we do to take advantage of that? Well, we can incrementally increase this graphics card here and add Pentium components, or, you know, take advantage of the Pentium's instruction sets. Then MMX comes along, and, oh, okay, well, we need to make these games that take advantage of that. Well, then now we need to make a certain kind of sound card to take advantage of these faster games, and now we have to make a, ooh, there's 3D games. What can we do for that? Crazy joysticks, 3D joysticks, 6 degrees of freedom joysticks. You know, it's just, yeah, it seems like everything was in these weird little 6 month intervals. If you missed out on 6 months of news, then, well, you were so far behind compared to just about any other point in time, especially the mid 90s there.
You're just kind of starting over at that point. If you, that's so bizarre to me about, the computer industry, I guess, especially in this era. But as someone who, you know, like, I played computer games in the late 90s and early 2000s, but was not a computer gamer, I would say. You know, I had just a handful of games I was into. But, I mean, what does it take to talk about a lot of these games? I mean, you're not just, it's one thing to be like, okay, Roller Coaster Tycoon was popular, whatever. But it's like, not all of these games play nice with a sort of like, well, I mean, is there even a standard computer setup at any point in the 90s? Like, is there anything you could consider standard? And then, you know, how do you just navigate trying to find out what works with what?
I, at one point, probably could have pointed to a specific computer and said, this will play most things. But as my definition of most things continued to change, you know, I got out of the mainstream of the go-to games, you know, your Duke Nukems and Quakes and Unreals and Half-Life and stuff. But then you start moving out there, and there were so many companies making games where they just didn't care about the standards, or they didn't put exactly the same processes into developing a game. And now you can have a CPU from 1996 that doesn't work with a game from 1995, for instance. And so there's this tiny little period. Like, I just recently built a computer that was specifically to play Ubisoft's Pod from 1997 because you can switch from one CPU to another and it will not work between the two, even though they were within like a 6 month to a year long period of being released. And the game supposedly supports all of these things, but that's one of those where they were trying to optimize it for MMX, and they were trying to optimize it for early Direct 3D and 3DFX Glide, but also supporting these other standards, and some of them they had, and there's one specific French sound card that it was built to use. So you get a lot of weird glitchy kind of sound if you don't use it on that one Maxi Muse sound card. I have a lot of computers, and at that point, or at this point, I'm really just building computers to try and, it's not a yearly thing, but it's turned into that. I've almost got a computer per year now where, I just mostly end up looking at either the games that came out or just looking at magazines from that era and seeing what they were building at the time, and then trying to base my builds around that. And that's extremely helpful, because otherwise you're just kind of lost in a land of infinitely configurable parts, and many of them don't work together.
I mean, this is fascinating to me, as someone who thinks about quite often, you know, what is the original version of this game, right? Like, what is the author intended rendition of this game? And often, you know, you can even get pretty deep even with console stuff, right? It's like, well, what kind of display was the artist using, right? But when you're talking about computer games, you're talking about, like, you know, literally, these are the components that the authors were targeting and used during development. And I just feel like, when it comes to computer games of this era, there's probably not very many people doing the work that you do to document, you know, how these games are were meant to render.
Yeah, that was one of the more interesting parts of this as I was getting started 12 years ago or whatever it was. It was trying to not just rely on emulators, things like DOSBox and, you know, I mean, obviously those are great. Those do a whole lot. They get a very quick, you know, avenue to being able to play something. But especially back then, the emulation wasn't quite as good as it is now. So there was that part of it. But then there's just the whole aspect of a lot of these games kind of look terrible when you put them up to 1080p or, you know, like back then you were going to play these games and they were going to be like sub 10 frames per second. It's just how it was. It wasn't meant to be, you know, I see a lot of people covering Doom, for instance, and they're playing a modern source port where it's playing at 60 FPS or something. Well, Doom was never meant to do that. It played at 35, you know, the half of the 70 Hertz that the game was meant to do. And so, you know, you can get that and interpolated animations and all these things that make completely no sense if you're trying to make an authentic Doom video. But, you know, most folks, I guess, just maybe that's not as big of a concern. But for me, I think it's important to get that context of when it came out. And if you don't have that context, then you might end up treating something unfairly, whether it's being too generous or not generous enough. And then, yeah, just finding that balance has always been an interesting challenge, because I don't want to make things look horrible to watch on video, but I also don't want to alter it too terribly much either. And then just deciding where that middle ground is, especially for things like sound cards, for instance, because all these sound cards have different sound chips. So what were most people using? Well, probably a Sound Blaster or something with these nice little FM synthy noises and basic PCM sound. But if you spent more money, you could have gotten a really nice MIDI synthesizer from Roland. And that's actually how a lot of these games were composed, is with a Roland synth. So is that the more accurate, even though nobody pretty much had one? You know, it's like the composers used it, so that's legit and it supports it. But nobody I knew had one of those. They were ridiculously expensive. You know, they were meant for musicians and composers. But yeah, the sound in particular is one of those where I just have to make a call sometimes which way to present it.
Listen, I don't care what people had. You play Loom, you get the MT32 patch in there. And okay. Kelsey, I'm reminded a lot of Kim Justice from a past episode.
That's exactly what I was thinking of too. Yeah.
Did I read that from your brain? Yeah, yep. Because we had Kim on the show to talk about Trespasser, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. And she had done a sort of video documentary on it. And she did show, you know, essentially how the game ran on a system of its time, like actually a pretty good system of its time, if I recall, and it still ran like crap. And she was kind of showing, you know, how modern patches have improved the performance. And I think in that case, it's almost like the insight you get is not what it was, but like how it sort of might have been in their heads before reality set in.
Right, the intention rather than,
yeah,
you know, the actual execution of it. Because there is a difference. I mean, it's, you can want something to look a certain way or perform a certain way, even if that standard, you know, what means like a $10,000 PC or whatever. Like if that's the design, I think it's worth showing as well, or at least talking about, even if that's not what anybody experienced. And I don't know. And that's what strikes me as so crazy about covering PC stuff. It's just, I don't think anyone, like, how could any two people have had the same experience playing a game? So how do you even begin to talk about a game when everyone's going to be remembering it slightly differently?
I think there is something of a collective nostalgia as well, because people tend to remember games looking and running and feeling better than they actually were. So I think if you can kind of mimic that to a way that's not completely unbelievable in a video, then I'm entirely fine with doing that. As long as, you know, it looks presentable in video form. Like one that I was covering, I have no concept of time. Sometime last year at this point, Need for Speed 2, when I played it, It had a terrible frame rate. It was at the very lowest resolution. It wasn't quite up to snuff. It didn't have a 3D accelerator, but I decided to do the video with all the bells and whistles because that's how everybody saw it in the magazine screenshots. And that's how everybody sort of kind of collectively remembers it. And I was showing some people early footage and they're like, wow, it looks terrible. I don't remember it looking like that. And I showed some other people the 3D accelerated version and they're like, what are all those? There's reflections on cars? Where did those come from? So I kind of mixed between the two different types of footage and tried to establish in that video that there were very distinct versions of this game released. And, you know, they sold the upgrade at retail. Most people ended up getting one version or the other, just depending on when they were going to the store. For me, I got that one pretty early on, but, you know, most other people I talked to tended to get the later one. And of course, that's the one everybody tries to run now because there are some glide wrappers and some software things that allow it to run better on modern systems, whereas the original version of it just doesn't. So now most people, if they're showing footage of it, they're showing that one or they go to the consoles because that one's just easier to run. So yeah, that's a fun experience. Crysis was another one of those where I wasn't sure how I wanted to present it. Because that game, of course, nobody could run it when it came out.
That was the joke. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the whole thing.
Yeah.
You still can't run Crysis properly. So it's like, you know, do I show it running in 640 by 480 with the lowest settings? And, you know, so I did at the beginning of the video. I'm like, here's how we ran Crysis. But of course, I bumped it up a little bit and I'd sort of try to draw the line at keeping things in a 4:3 aspect ratio too, because, you know, obviously that's another thing that kind of drives me nuts. See somebody doing like a retrospective of a game from 1995 and it's in 16:9. I'm like, what is this? Modern source port, you know? It's like, it's cool, but it sort of makes the game easier because now you can see more of it. But anyway.
Well, I mean, I'm curious where this is coming from for you. I mean, is it important to you that people specifically understand the way that the game was commonly played in its time, you know, versus like thinking of a game as something that can be sort of remastered and reimagined now?
I think it's all valid, and you know, that's why I do try to cover those when it makes sense. You know, if there is a modern update or source port, I will put that in my video if I think about it. For the most part, where I'm coming from is about that context of its release window, so to speak, how it was received back then or how I remember it being received, and then try to balance that out with how it actually was. And somewhere on that middle ground, eventually a video will come together. You know, like with Unreal Tournament, I wanted to show that, hey, there are these fantastic modern updates. There's a whole group that is still, with Epic Games' blessing, updating that on a regular basis. So you can completely get that going on like DirectX 11 graphics and everything. But for the most part, I just present that at the end as like, hey, here it is now. But I just wanted to present it on exactly the hardware that I had it on back then, which is a 16 megabyte Voodoo 3. And for me, in my head canon, that is as it should look, 16-bit textures and all.
So that's a pretty good segue to something I wanted to talk about, which is just the, you know, we mentioned the Unreal Tournament video at the beginning of this podcast. But, you know, one of the things you talked about that is sort of the role of fans and modders in shaping the game into what it eventually became. And I think, you know, Frank and I, who are mostly console people growing up, really missed out on that early understanding that people make video games. You know, you mentioned like, I saw people modding this game and I thought maybe that means I could go work at a video game company. I never had that. I didn't figure that out until I was in college. Like, obviously I knew people made video games, but it never was like a really fully formed thought to me until I was in college and was like, oh yeah, like that could be an actual career. So, I don't know. I just want to talk a little bit about what did modders do for PC games back in this era?
Yeah, that's something that I wish was more prevalent now. I mean, you know, there obviously are some standout examples of people modifying games, but it's mostly sanctioned.
What are you talking about? There's so many nude mods for Skyrim. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, see, that was built into the game from the start. Not the nudity exactly, but the ability to add all the nudity you want. It's just, that's something Bethesda embraced. But I remember back with Morrowind or especially Morrowind. Yeah, it was a thing where they had some basic creation tools added by that point. But if you wanted to go really, really, really in depth with it, you had to, you know, modify the modifications and start making your own. Or, you know, even before that, I remember one of my first experiences with the, I don't even know what you'd call it, the extra curricular modders out there, Need for Speed 3. And that was a game that was not built to be modded at all. It was not a thing. But there were some people that came together all around the world and started building tools to do that. And all of a sudden, you got this explosion of free cars and tracks and graphical updates and patches. And this was 1998. So it was hopping online and just seeing what the next, you know, person from Russia had put together. And I remember seeing this guy. I don't know if he was from Russia, but, you know, he was somewhere in Europe, I believe. And I remember he made the 1998 Dodge Viper GTS Coupe mod for that. And he put it in the game, ended up getting hired by EA. I remember he put out a thing on the forums in like 1999. He's just like, "Hey guys, I'm glad you enjoyed my mods. I won't be making any more. And that's because I got hired to work on the next Need for Speed games." And that blew my mind. 1998, 1999. I want to say his name was Dave Arroyo. Anyway, yeah, that I very clearly remember that, and just reading it and being like, "Whoa, oh, I gotta get, figure out how to make cars," you know. So
you can
I did.
Do that. Yeah. You can work, and then companies will see it and hire you. It's very like I don't know. It's almost like how athletes work. Like people are getting scouted out of right. modding, which I think is just the coolest thing.
Yeah, there's sort of an athletic part to it. Except that most people aren't pirating the gym in order to get better. As I know, I remember on the forums, people were like, "Hey, just go here and download this version of 3D Studio Max. And here's a crack for it. I made it myself. It works great." You know, so the tools themselves, a lot of times when you're talking about modeling and all that, those were still very much premium. But hey, it was the modding community. They were like, "Let's just share it all, including the tools." That's how I got my first hint into 3D modeling, is that one specific link. So whoever you were 20 something years ago posting that 3D Studio Max, it was great. In fact, this was so funny. On the forums, they said specifically that if you send a letter to this address at Autodesk, they will send you a demo CD for 3D Studio Max, because it was huge. And downloading it on dial-up didn't make much sense. So they were like, "Send in for the free demo CD. That demo CD can then be activated using this code." And so everybody was doing that I knew. I still have this.
Not only pirating, but like making them spend money.
Yes.
To send you the disc.
It was like a thing. And they were like, "Oh yeah, we'll send out a free timed demo." It came with a VHS tape as well. I still have the tape. It's great stuff.
Yeah. I mean, Kelsey, to your point, I think my experience with learning people made games, it was fairly early for me. It was a feature in Nintendo Power about the making of Super Mario Brothers 3, and it was, you know, Shigeru Miyamoto and like Tessica, I believe.
Yeah, but those are Japanese people.
Well,
adults.
Yeah, that's
they're
what I was
real.
About to say. Like they weren't real people.
Yeah.
At like a company that someone might work at, they were Nintendo, and that's right. Just what Nintendo looks like. But those aren't real people. Those are Nintendo people.
Exactly. I needed to see people at least somewhat close to my age or interests doing this work in order for it to really sink in and make me understand, like, oh no, like literally anyone can do this.
Yeah. 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 We weren't PC kids. That's why we're late bloomers when it comes to this. So when you're explaining, you know, these older PC concepts, on your videos, like, at what level do you start? I mean, who do you sort of assume your viewer is in terms of their existing knowledge?
Yeah, that is tough, because I used to very much just cater it to my own knowledge level, and that was very limiting in terms of the audience. And so I kind of skewed very much in the other direction and making things highly approachable and covering stuff that was more well-known. And for me, I didn't find that particularly engaging, because I don't know, I just found it somewhat mundane to give such a broad overview of a subject that it was just like, you can see that on Wikipedia. So what am I doing?
I don't need to explain the voodoo again.
Yeah, it's like, so at minimum, I assume that somebody at least knows the same computers that I was familiar with existed. Maybe they don't know how they work, but they at least know, you know, for instance, what a Voodoo is or what a Sound Blaster is. And if nothing else, it's really been helped by the YouTube community in the past 5 or 10 years around PC stuff exploding. And now everybody has sort of a common vernacular for a lot of these things. Like it's kind of fascinating to see more and more folks doing similar things to what I'm doing in terms of making retrospectives and talking about PC hardware. Whereas when I started, nobody was doing it. That's why I started. So I feel like it's just built up to a point where I can be a little more cavalier with just talking about things. And you know, I have a lot of folks that will send in comments and messages saying, I have no idea what you're talking about, but it's engaging. So I continue watching. So if there's that, then that's good. But yeah, I still don't exactly know the answer to that in terms of who in the world it's made for. I don't know. I guess the imaginary LGR audience in my head. I assume that they constantly have some awareness of these type of things. And if nothing else, I'm going to drill it in their heads by doing like 50 videos and rolling sound canvases. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I first started watching your videos, there were definitely some terms that were not super familiar to me, but I don't feel like you ever approach it in a way that's like, only if you are a PC nerd will you ever like be welcome here and understand what the heck is going on here.
That's the last thing I want. I want everybody to feel like they are welcome to just sort of join in on the fun. And, you know, really it is just about having fun with these old things and experiencing them how they were. And, you know, that is an ongoing thing. If you step into that just on the deep end without any experience whatsoever, that's one of the most common emails that I get is, how do I even get started with these retro computers? I've made a few videos on that topic just because everybody has a different answer. A lot of folks don't even need to mess with the hardware side of things because emulation and virtualization has gotten so good. I often just recommend that, like, hey, if you like tweaking those settings, then maybe you would like to go on eBay and grab something old and seeing if it works. And then once you do that, you realize that a lot of these things have started to die off and got capacitor plague and all sorts of batteries exploding on stuff. And that gets into a whole realm of where half the time you're not even playing games, you're just repairing. So
is this your descent that you're talking about? Like, it started with emulation and now it's a slow descent into trying to fix and collect everything in order to make it all work.
Yeah, I was always into these, you know. Even in high school, I was sort of just making cash as I could, repairing up old computers and reselling them and things like that, just buying them from thrift stores when you could still do that. And at a certain point, I just started amassing things that I wanted but never could afford, or it was too obscure. And, you know, that was very much my own descent into madness there, was finding increasingly bizarre items. And then something eventually was just so bizarre, I had to do a video on it. And there's that.
Well, I mean, I'm curious what continues, you know, to drive you. Is it wanting to fill in the gaps of your youth, maybe, or is it just like, because it's an endless hole to play these games accurately, it's an endless collection of parts? I mean, what keeps you going?
Yeah, it is a bit of a nesting doll thing where the more that I dive into the more it keeps increasing. But I guess it's sort of the other way around. Instead of them getting smaller, it gets bigger. So every time it opens me up and I start learning one topic, that brings me on to 5 or 6 other topics that I didn't even know were related or that people are still interested in. Or it's kind of like when you discover importing things from Japan, you all of a sudden realize that there's an entire different world and different way of looking at games and electronics that we just didn't get in the West for the most part. And that's something that I try to not go too far down myself, because they had a fantastic computer economy that is completely different than ours. You know, same with the UK, those in particular. Going down that rabbit hole was something I was doing more often in the past because it was so different and so interesting. And now that I sort of scratched that itch over the years, I've started to zero in specifically on that period in time that I remember the most fondly as a kid. And just, again, going through a whole lot of magazines and newspapers and old TV shows, seeing exactly what they were messing with, and just kind of getting a feel for it. For some reason, I find that supremely engaging. Like, it's the closest to time travel I can do. And just sort of revisiting an era that I kind of remember, but mostly don't. So I don't know. It's just, I guess that's what drives me, is the fact that it feels like time travel.
So this might be a large or loaded question, I'm not sure, but as you're exploring all of these hardware configurations and finding out, I mean, you mentioned POD earlier, you know, that there's a lot of games that, you know, sort of require very specific parts to function correctly. What would you say, now that you've sort of built up this knowledge base and experience, is missing most when it comes to virtualizing the sort of thing?
The graphics and sound is a very particular thing from that era, and it really has not yet gotten to the point where I'm comfortable using it completely emulated or virtualized. And you know, Windows 95, 98, even early XP kind of era stuff, there's still a whole section of that which is not emulated whatsoever, or if it is, it's just a weird approximation of it where everything is slightly off in terms of the speed and performance. And most, I was messing around with a 486 recently, and somebody was saying, hey, you should try this other emulator because it emulates that specific processor in a certain way that might be beneficial. But then I looked into it and saw that the emulator doesn't even take into consideration cache sizes, which was a huge thing back then. So I'm like, well, yeah, it's cool that it's there and it supposedly emulates the same instructions, but the speed is completely off. So benchmarking is useless and comparing results is kind of useless. So there's all these little minutiae. Sound cards and, you know, sound chips in particular, that's an endless rabbit hole for me, because the whole particular way that so many different chips were manufactured and the variances in them. And so trying to emulate that, you end up with something, it's like with Sega Genesis emulation for the longest time. It sounded wrong. There's a certain twang, a certain kind of high frequency.
Depending on the hardware model.
All of those. Those individual things that people obsess over. You could easily obsess over it 10 times over for sound cards, because everybody had a different supplier. And so, yeah, maybe it's not important, but it's fun. And it's interesting to obsess over. And the graphic side of things, that's another one of like 1995, 1997. You know, now we have graphics standards. Well, at one point they weren't standards, and literally everybody was trying their own thing. So before you had Direct3D, you had, of course, the 3DFX Glide things, and Matrox was doing something, and S3 was doing something, and everybody else had their own standards. ATI and NVIDIA tried their own chips before they decided on OpenGL and Direct3D. So at that point, you could have a game with 10 different versions, you know, and they all look completely different, and they all run completely different. They have different textures. They have different soundtracks. They have different draw distances. They have a different menu or loading screen, because sometimes an animation wouldn't work on one card, but it would on another. So yeah, MechWarrior 2 comes to mind as one of those that just has like 20 different versions for different sound cards and drivers and processors. Every single one of them are different. So,
but which one's the real one? Is that something that like scares you or excites you? Because for exciting. Me, it feels like a little bit of both. I'm like,
yeah,
that's cool that there's 20 different versions, but what's the right one? What am I supposed to play?
I don't know. I think it's really just down to whatever you want to look at. It's one reason I enjoy the like Digital Foundry videos whenever they do retrospectives on old computer games, because they really dive into that nitty gritty comparison. And there's such a minor difference between them all, but it's there. You know, one version has fog, another one doesn't. Another one has colored lighting, this one doesn't. You know, shadows. There's always a trade-off, and everybody has their own preferences, usually based on what they remember. But, you know, I just find it fun to see what everybody was trying, and, you know, finding a graphics card that only like 8 games were made for it. Like, imagine spending $300, $400, or $500 and you can play 8 games forever. That's it. And everything else was just rendering in software mode, which was no acceleration, no effects, no extra graphics. You know, you're just limited. I don't know. It was a time that I'm glad that I wasn't spending money on graphics cards, because He could be left behind and not even know it. He could bet on the wrong horse, and like 90% of the horses were, you know, half dead and nobody knew it.
Poor horses.
I know.
Your analogies today are just killer.
Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about with there being trade-offs and things on these games, I think that's rough for a lot of people, myself included, because I think humans have this weird brain bug where we value what we perceive as authenticity above all other things. And when there's not like one correct answer for how a game was supposed to be, like I think it kind of breaks some people.
Yeah, there's the "well, actually" crowd is kind of what got me onto that in the first place. Because, you know, you get into the comments and they're like, "Well, actually, if you had this other version with this other one specific thing, and you could run it this way, and that problem or that one effect you were talking about was totally fixed in this other one." And it's like, okay. And now I kind of feel like I can't cover a topic unless I know everything about it, which is a dangerous thing. But, you know, there's always a what if or what about that or the other. And in a way, that is a lot of the appeal, is just trying to cover as many of those bases without going completely insane. But, you know, now that I at least do have enough of the hardware to manage that, it makes it fun, because now you can just like swap in and out all these different components. You know, it's like getting an old car and seeing what in the world you can modify on it, what kind of parts of the engine you can swap out, and what other modifications make sense, which are anachronistic, which ones are just cool. You know, you want to make it sound different, look different, feel different. It's all there. And that's the way I approach old computers, is they're an endless project. That's sort of more fun than actually playing the games.
Well, and I mean, you talk about researching this stuff in magazines, and I'm sure you're reading like old reviews and that sort of thing. I mean, is this a thing that magazine reviewers and editors were struggling with back then? Or were they just like, well, this is the version we have, this is the version we're reviewing?
Yeah, there was a lot of struggle with that. I've seen in many different magazines, especially from that weird era of graphics cards, and they would sort of throw their hands up and saying, okay, fine, this is the configuration we've got, we're going with that one, but there's this one, and this one on the way, supposedly. And so, you know, you would have to go to a store and roll the dice and see if they had that particular version in stock, or more often than not, send off for something from the company to get it. I'm sure that was an absolute pain for editors and reviewers and anybody dealing with that in magazines. But for the most part, I saw them kind of roll it up into like, here's a big graphics card shootout, or a sound card, just, you know, whatever. We're going to try the most common games and applications people are doing, and then just putting them all in there and lumping them together. And yeah, I don't know. I kind of feel like I'm doing some of that myself, but most of that doesn't actually make it into the video. That's all the stuff that I do before the video. And then you decide to do the video based on what you find with all these different configurations. So
is that the main use of that vintage source material, is determining hardware? Or do you mine other things, just like, you know, opinions of the games from the times and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I pay less attention to the opinions and more to the sort of objective journalism and coverage, things like that. You know, whereas it's extremely handy for finding original price points, for instance, and tracking down when something actually did release, because a lot of times you'll go and you'll find an article on something and you'll see that, oh, it was released in this year. But it turns out they were actually just looking at the PCB and it says like 1993, when in actuality, it didn't go into the market until 1995. So there's a lot of weird little discrepancies, and it's really handy to look at old articles, and press releases especially are really handy for that. But yeah, some companies were just terrible about putting certain suggested prices in there that completely didn't match up at all. And that's where I end up going to newspapers and seeing what the actual local retailers were doing, because that completely changes. Suggested prices are just that, suggested. And if every single retailer was giving a $50 rebate immediately, then that's effectively what it was. And then you get into Japanese things and they don't even have suggested prices. It's like some other kind of thing where it's you just make up your own price based on the current value of the yen. I was doing research on a Japanese computer recently, and that was it. Sony just said, there's no suggested price for this computer. So see your local retailer. And it's like, okay, how do I find a local retailer? Where are the archives for the Japanese newspaper like listings? We have all these flyers here, and you could find those in a lot of the newspaper archives for US and Canadian, even Australian, but Japan, eh. So I ended up having to just start diving through old GeoCities blogs and like just, I don't know what it is, but there was a certain, I know there's a term for it, but these certain types of Japanese bloggers way back, and they would get, it was almost like a day-to-day experience with this system that they had bought. And so every day they would update it with all the things they went through. Here's what I paid for it. Here's what I'm doing with it. Here's the unboxing. You know, it was kind of ahead of its time looking at it. It's really cool to see. And that's the way I found the price of that computer, is because they said, Sony doesn't have a price, but here's what I found it for at the local shop. And so, yeah.
Yeah, Japanese research is very difficult if you, I mean, A, if you don't speak the language, obviously, and then B, even just not physically being in Japan, because the diet libraries in Japan, they have very, very good archives, actually. They even have, I mean, they have like full runs of almost every video game magazine, from what I understand, which is crazy. But we don't have anything, we don't have that here in, like, you know, the Library of Congress for reference. But you have to physically go to Japan and like speak the language and know how to request those items and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so, I will definitely admit to having relied on a couple of folks volunteering their time to look up something, because otherwise it's just kind of a black hole of information when it comes to certain topics that, you know, there's one thing that came out in 1999. Who archived it and who talked about it? Probably no one, but I'm sure there's something in a magazine somewhere.
So what is your sort of wish list right now of historical documentation, be it magazines or whatever, that isn't currently online that you sort of wish was?
I mean, that's certainly one of them, in terms of things from other countries that maybe they just don't have the same, I don't know what it is. Belief maybe in archiving and putting everything online for everybody to see that we do here. You know, obviously things like Internet Archive are great, but the search function is garbage. So that's something that's gotten in my way a lot. Better search functionality would be fantastic.
Yeah.
And just rescanning a lot of old things, really, because a lot of these archives are really, really old.
Yeah.
A lot of magazines and newspapers that I found, I don't know when they were scanned, but it was a long time ago and they haven't been updated since. And the other thing is just sort of slightly related and completely overlooked is the drivers and the software that came with these things. I think I was trying to get a monitor working from 20 years ago recently, and that one, okay, so there's one specific driver and you needed to download it from the website for the manufacturer. Okay, I found the archive of the website. Well, guess what? You had to email them for access. And it's like, who has that anymore? Does somebody save that on an old disk? You know, and a lot of folks just aren't backing up old floppy disks and CDs for very generic drivers.
Right. That's, I mean, like, if anything, they downloaded that on their hard drive at the time, installed it, deleted the zip file. That was it, right?
Yeah. The documentation is another big part of it. There's a ton of manuals and documentation for things that simply are not out there when it comes to computer hardware and software, mostly the hardware side of things. You know, you get a controller card that's meant to work with a few old hard drives from the 80s, but there's like 100 little jumper settings on the card. You have to know what those jumpers do. And if it's not printed on the card, you better hope somebody saved it somewhere along the line. And there are a few good resources for that, but again, they're very, very old. So, and it's either that or they end up in some shady website where they want you to pay $99 a year to access all of their manuals. And it's like, well, what is that about? You know, I just need one manual.
We've done that for software that we needed.
Yeah.
Well, and like
sometimes you got to.
Yeah. And like you were saying earlier, I mean, things were changing just so quickly in this era. You know, every 6 months, it was almost like a complete overhaul. And so there's just, I mean, even if there were good faith efforts being made to scan things at the time or put the software online at the time, it's just that there was too much. Like, who's going to be doing all that work?
Especially when it was all seen as largely disposable, or at least in my experience. You know, I was in a computer class in high school for a couple of years, and that was literally the thing to do. You know, the school had all these computers and things going back to the 80s, hardware and software, but every summer it was time to dump. And so you would go to the back of the class or the back storage area and literally dump it all in the dumpster, the stuff that we're not going to use anymore. You know, dozens and dozens of computers, hundreds of manuals and floppies, all of these things. It was literally just dump it. Nobody needs it. It's all obsolete. It's just trash. And increasingly, a lot of those things that seemed extremely mundane at the time, like the one stupid driver CD for that one monitor, I still can't find it. It's a monitor from 2004. You'd think somebody would have kept it.
No, that's, but, that, I feel like it gets worse when you get into the 2000s somehow. Like people completely stop caring about, I mean, we've run into this even with like magazines. Like it's so difficult to find magazines from the mid to late 2000s. Those were actual trash to people. Whereas like the 90s magazines, like people kind of treasured those, and you know, enough people kept them around. Obviously a ton got thrown away, but
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this often. It's like, who was subscribing to like official Xbox magazine from 2010 to 2019? Like where, like we literally can't find those, but they were printed. And in fact, they were printed in two different versions in the UK and US, but like go to eBay, they don't exist. It's a little difficult to find that stuff.
Yeah, I've been going down a journey recently and kind of wrapping around back to Unreal Tournament. It was the thing that put me down that path was PC Gamer magazine and their demo discs. And the demo discs I was able to find, but the magazines that went along with it, nope.
Yeah.
Not at all. And that reminded me of that, oh yeah, that's how I got into Unreal Tournament in the first place, was that one demo disc that had some sort of like pre-release assets and everything in there. It was really fascinating. And so I just started going down this path of trying to figure out how in the world, or if anybody in the world, was collecting the discs alongside the magazines and keeping them together. Practically no one seemed to be. You can get them sometimes separately, but so far I've had little luck doing that. And I was even talking to the PC Gamer editor-in-chief back then, Gary Whitta, about it. And he's like, even I don't have those.
Yeah.
He didn't keep them himself. And he was the editor-in-chief.
So. Yeah, I mean, I can speak for us. I mean, I'm looking as if I can see it, but it's actually, I'd have to have x-ray through this bookshelf in front of me. But, you know, we, even us, it's like we do have a fairly substantial archive of PC Gamer, but it's just the US edition, and it's from issue one until, you know, maybe mid 2013 for reasons we just outlined, like, because who had that in 2014? And it's like,
I was wondering about the demo discs. Do you have the demo discs to go with them?
We have somewhere in storage. I can visualize the two giant boxes we have that are just magazine discs, because we just we haven't like cataloged them or looked at them or anything, because my assumption, and again, like we're so limited in resources at the foundation, is just we can't do everything. It's like my assumption is like, these are probably ripped somewhere. The discs, the magazines, probably not. The discs, probably yes. But if not, I know where this giant box is, and we can go digging if someone really, really needs something. But yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, we don't, eventually we hope to, but it's like, yeah, even we don't keep them together. We just, we have the magazines in order on a shelf, and we have, separately from that, have stockpiled discs that just kind of make their way to us over the years. But yeah, we haven't really done a good job of uniting them, but it's rough. I mean, it's probably easier for those because it probably says the actual issue number on the disc that it goes with.
Yeah.
But we also have like two file boxes full of like, these came in poly bags with a magazine. Which one? Shrug. You know, but these were things that we're pretty sure were with magazines, and it's kind of rough to keep that stuff together. But then the other thing that came to mind as you were talking is like, we've not collectively done a good job of digitizing computer game magazines, period. Computer Gaming World has them all scanned, which is great, but you know, PC Gamer's got a ton of holes. And then there's a magazine that almost no one talks about, which is that Sendai had Computer Game Review from, I think, 92 to like 97, which is a pretty good chunk of time. And last I looked, there were exactly two issues scanned of that. We're about to send about like 30 something off to a scanning group, but it's like, you know, some of the stuff is hard to locate, and the labor for scanning magazines is very, very grueling and terrible, and hard to find volunteers for. Get in touch, by the way, if you want to edit some magazine scans that are raw.
It's really not fun volunteers. Work.
It's terrible. But terrible.
No. It's one of the things I get requests for very, very often whenever I cover a game or show a piece of hardware is please scan the documentation. And I just don't have anything equipped to do that very easily. And, you know, it's either get a whole big group of things and send them off somewhere, or, you know, just get to it eventually. And that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Yeah, we'll get to it. Yeah.
That's yeah, great. Eventually.
Just one
yeah,
of you sure. want to come to my house and just do it here. Here's the stack, you know. It's a lot of labor. And, you know, you slow down other good work by doing that. And so it's difficult to... Prioritizing is difficult. And yeah. I mean, maybe we don't always make the correct or the same prioritization assumptions that other people would, but I don't know. There's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. And basically we ask you, as we have in the past, like what's missing so we can feel bad about ourselves.
Right.
Oh, we're not doing our job. You're doing yours, but we're not helping you.
We're not helping fast enough.
Yeah, I don't know. Should we talk about Unreal Tournament for a minute? I mean, we kind of discussed it at the top of the hour, right?
Sure.
So, I mean, I think, you know, I think it might be worth going back a little bit, because I think people are familiar with Unreal as an engine, and perhaps these days don't realize that it kind of was part and parcel with a game of the same name.
Yeah, that was kind of surprising whenever I covered the original Unreal, was all the kids coming into the chat being like, what, the Fortnite people? How did this happen? So I kind of felt like I should have covered that a little bit more in retrospect. Maybe I still will at some point, because, yeah, the history of engines being made to license out, like that was very kind of one of the early days of that. Id Software, of course, was really kicking that off. But, yeah, that sort of early era of 3D shooters where everybody had their own proprietary engine and coming up with their own tech, and you know, you needed some super genius at your company to head the thing on, you know, whether it was Carmack or Sweeney or whoever. But yeah, I, in particular, Unreal Tournament was always mind-blowing to me back then, just as an engine and what it could do. So it is kind of funny seeing it now on so many products and, you know, TV shows and movies and everything else using it, where yeah, it started off as just a neat little tech demo.
Yeah, we have a bunch of assets and stuff from the early Unreal days. We tried to get Epic to like fund our digitization product. They didn't reply to us.
Oh.
So if you work at Epic and you listen to this show, man, we got some cool stuff.
Yeah, we applied for one of your grants.
Oh, man.
Reconsider.
Yeah, so Unreal Tournament specifically is a game that captured your imagination at the time. Everyone go check out the video. We will link to it in the show description. You know, tell us about the game briefly. Like, why should people care? Why should people go check this out?
Because it's daggum fun. It's just a great time. You know, I think I put it in my video that it's the type of shooter that simply isn't made anymore. And every time it's been tried to sort of bring it back from the dead or come up with a new arena shooter, as they were calling it, it usually falls flat on its face, because I think just the market's completely changed in what they want. So if, for instance, you might be tired of the current crop of shooters, or, you know, the more hero oriented style of gameplay or the battle royales and such, it all kind of originated back there in terms of that level of energy and just taking the excitement level up from something like what Doom or Quake originally were with simple deathmatch, to adding all of these other things that became staples like capture the flag and sort of domination modes and assault modes, and adding all of the little mutators was another really big part of it. And it kind of is It's one of those desert island games for me, because it's if I were to be stuck somewhere and I needed a game that was endless, I would choose that and maybe a couple others because of the customization aspect. You know, they had these little tiny mods that were built into the game called mutators. And so if you didn't like this certain weapon or this certain aspect of gameplay, you could drop that in there in the menu and then completely change it. All of a sudden you've got a totally custom game type and you can make up on the fly. And it was the first time I had actually seen that, where it was built into the game and it wasn't something you had to go and edit files to make happen. So it's still really engaging for that aspect. If you're into the high energy Twitch shooters and arena shooters and just that late 90s Quake 3 and Unreal Tournament, those were the two. And back then, they were just head-to-head competing for everybody's attention. Everybody picked one camp or the other. I was firmly in the UT camp, but enjoyed Quake 3 for what it was, more so later on. And, you know, that one ended up taking off more in esports than anything. And Unreal Tournament was just more of a, I'm not even sure why, but it ended up being is more just the fun one to fart around with at LAN parties for us. Maybe because of the extra customization, but.
Well, and I think there's probably also some element of, like, I mean, you talked about getting it off of a demo disc and playing those same, you know, what was on the demo disc over and over again. And I think maybe we don't like to admit it, but I think a lot of times that sort of colors our preferences too. It's like, I played this one a lot, therefore it's the better one.
Yeah, that's definitely huge, because that was the one, you know, I spent all the time with it. Now I'm invested in it and now I'm going to play it forever, you know. And then going to other games that were similar back then, it feels like riding a different type of bike and you just don't know where the controls are. What are all these things? And
the it's like a French shower. Isn't. Like, oh, this is wrong. I don't know why. It just doesn't it's work like the same way.
You turn this knob and then it's cold instead of hot and you don't know why. Yeah, it's I love them both. But yeah, it's that particular set of things in the late 90s there. It came together and everything was all cyber goth all the time. Everybody had trench coats and weird implants and drum and bass music. And if you were there, that was the coolest thing.
Like, you, I mean, you're describing Deus Ex, but you're describing like 10 other games too. So the reason I revisit old games is I think less for nostalgia and more for just trying to find the pieces that we dropped. You know what I mean? That we never picked back up. Is there any of that in Unreal Tournament, in the older Unreal Tournament, that's like, oh, maybe this is something worth actually exploring, or it's something that like we just don't see anymore?
Yeah, that style of gameplay where it is so directly simple.
Yeah.
These are very straightforward game modes. There's not any kind of ladder experience, upgrades, anything like that, except for what you want it to be. You know, it's literally you go in there and you shoot your friends. That's it. So whether or not you want to add more to that is completely up to you, but it's as simple as it gets for that type of thing. But at the same time, it was offering so many additional features that it made it pretty endlessly engaging for a good while there. And, you know, the community just embraced it in a way that other games simply didn't get, whether it's deserved or not, you know, and it's kept it alive ever since. And it's, I do think that that's been lost a bit. I get a little overwhelmed whenever I go into a modern multiplayer shooter and all of a sudden there's 1,000 menus and 1,000,000,000 unlocks and all these skins and things you got to pay for. There's none of that. It's all just right there. You got like 5 different faces you can put on your guy and you can change between 4 colors. And that's
other than that, it's like a playground sport, right? Like you just play with your friends or bots as it would be.
The bots are also a thing. I those are still the best bots that I've used for that type of game. I mean, even compared to modern shooters, as the Unreal Tournament games, they had proprietary bot tech and it's very good.
Why aren't they as good anymore? Come on, get on that, Epic.
Epic owns the rights. They could stick them in whatever they want.
All right. Again, everyone, we encourage you to go check out Clint's video, Unreal Tournament 22 Years Later, a retrospective. It is on his YouTube. We will link that in the show notes. Clint, gosh, this is great. Thank you so much for joining us at the Video Game History Hour. Where can people find you on the internet?
YouTube.com/lazygamereviews, or just search LGR on YouTube. should pop up unless somebody's cloned me in the past couple days. So,
or if you typoed LRG.
LRG, yeah. Limited run games. No, it's pretty much just that. Everything else I do links right back to the YouTube channel because that's, you know, I have other little small side channels, but, you know, it's fine. LGR, right. That's where it's at.
Cool. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunimune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.